when the breath gets shallow and almost seemingly non-existent, could that be an indication of shutting down, closing down, numbing out?
It could be, yeah. There is a state of mind called sinking mind. And it's a very concentrated state and a very low energy state. So it is possible that if your energy is low and your concentration is good, you would get similar sort of thing happening, and your mind just sort of sinks into the breath, but you're so dull, non-alert, it's not a useful state. The thing about access concentration, yeah, there's a certain quality of alertness that's there that, yeah, it's pretty recognizable. Whereas the sinking mind, it's sort of like you're curling up in a ball and disappearing. And if that's happening, as Ayakema said, it's a totally useless state. Get yourself out of it immediately. Yeah, open your eyes, rub your cheeks, move around, and then start again. But yeah, that is a problem that can happen. And actually, on a retreat, I mean, if you've been on a residential retreat, you often know that, yeah, first day you're falling asleep. Second day you're falling asleep. So yeah, this can happen. When I teach a retreat, I don't expect anybody to start learning jhanas till the retreat's half over. You know, it's like you've got to get over the sleepiness and then you can start working with this. Other questions?
What about the arising of more difficult emotions?
What about the arising of difficult emotions? Yeah. There can be distractions arise that, you know, you slap a label on it and it still keeps coming back. And if that's the case, often what's necessary is, okay, not going to be able to work on jhanas right now. I'm going to have to work on this difficult emotion. At the start of all retreats, I tell students, okay, no expectations. And if you start working with concentration, yeah, any unresolved psychological issues may put in an appearance. So yeah, it's quite frequent that difficult emotions arise. And when I teach a retreat, people have one-on-one interviews with me, and I want to know, all right, what happens in your meditation? If difficult emotions are arising, then I guess that's what we talk about and see what I can do to help you deal with them, set them aside, whatever is possible. But yeah, the first strategy is just, yeah, not going there. And then if it's just like, okay, this has got to be worked on, then you've got to work on it. Right.
And if you can set this aside, is it okay to just like, okay, not dealing with
that? Not now.
Just this, not now, just right. This, not now. And that's helping.
Yeah. Basically, what your strategy is, all right, I'm going to get my mind as concentrated as I can, because once it's really concentrated, I'll be much better able to deal with everything, including the difficult emotions. So yeah, it's suppressing what's coming up, but it's only going to be temporarily suppressed. And sometimes what's actually necessary is, okay, yeah, you get into the jhanas, you got supremely concentrated mind, and then you turn your mind back to the difficult emotion. It usually is not as difficult at that point. In other words, you see it without it overwhelming you, and you've actually got a much better chance of working with it. So this is a strategy. I'd say there are two major types of insights, personal and general. And the personal ones are, yeah, personal stuff from your childhood, something that happened at work last week. You know, I mean, it could be, you know, anything that's really personal. And then the general ones are the insights into the impermanent nature of things, the unsatisfactory nature, and the empty, coreless nature of things. But to get to those three impersonal ones, it's often really necessary to work through the personal stuff because that's in the way. Yeah.
One thing that happens to me sometimes after 15, 20 minutes of going to a session, I have body movement and volunteering. I would sit up.
Mm-hmm.
There, I can't see an intention. I'm just wondering, how does that relate to concentration?
Yeah. Probably it's PT. They talk in the commentaries about PT coming in five grades. Momentary, which you just get a shiver that runs through you. Minor, and that's what you're getting. All right, it's not the full blown thing, but it's getting you to sit up straight and so forth. Showering PT, that would be a burst of PT and then it goes away, and another burst followed and it goes away. It doesn't sustain. Uplifting PT, that make you sit up, so you've got some momentary uplifting PT making you sit up there. And then all pervasive PT, or what I call full blown PT. And that's when it really comes and sustains. So, yeah, you're headed in the right direction. You're beginning to get some PT. Keep doing what you're doing. Find some pleasure. See what happens. Yeah.
Does everybody go through the diffuse white light phase to get to the journal?
No. I bring the diffuse white light up because for those people who see it, they at least know it's a sign they're going in the right direction. There are some people who never see it. There's some people who see it every time. The majority of people see it sometimes, and sometimes they don't. For myself, yeah, I can get to the jhanas without the diffuse white light, yeah, frequently. But if I get to the diffuse white light, it's going to be higher quality jhanas. In other words, I'm going to be more deeply concentrated. But yeah, so if it shows up, and a lot of people have seen this, and so now they know what's going on.
You also mentioned japa yoga, the repetition of a mantra.
Mm-hmm.
My experience is that the nada sound, the sound of silence, as Sumedho mentioned it, it started making the sound at a time when I started to do mantra meditation.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder if they're related, because the reason I ask is that I heard a teacher, I mentioned it to a teacher quite a few years ago, and she said, yes, I used to do that, but I have no use for it now because I prefer to do vipassana.
Right.
So do they sort of clash with each other?
Yeah, it's not so much that the mantra causes you to start hearing the nada sound. It's the concentration generated by the mantra that causes you to start hearing the nada sound. As people get concentrated, there can be various things that start showing up. And one of them is the sound in the ears starts getting much, much more prominent. Normally, there's so much going on. When you were meditating, did anybody hear the clock ticking? Has anybody heard the clock ticking since I've rung the bell? Well, no. It's not. I mean, if I'm silent right now. All right, who heard the clock ticking then? Yeah, not very many people. Okay? When your mind gets quiet, any little sound seems much louder. And so the sound in your ears is always there. You do the mantra, your mind starts getting quiet, and then you start noticing it. Other possible things could start happening when you get quiet. You might have body distortions. People talk about their hands getting huge, you know, like they're wearing 5 pair of mittens or something. Or the hands get very heavy and they can't lift them up, you know, it feels so heavy. Or they think they're sitting like this and they open their eyes and they're sitting upright. Or they think they're sitting upright and it turns out they're sitting like this. So you get all sort of things like that with concentration, and this nada sound getting louder is very common. And so the mantra just generated concentration. The concentration is what enabled the nada sound to get louder. And yeah, if you like working with the nada sound, work with it. Personally, I don't want to hear it, so I don't ever work with it. But I have used it enough. Ajahn Amaro used to come to the States, and he taught it to me. And so I used it and was like, yeah, I can get to the jhanas that way, but I don't want to hear it, so I don't want to train myself.
Remembering the story about the Buddha when he was a child, you know, sitting under a tree and watching the, was it the ploughing or, you know, harvesting and ploughing?
Right.
And I'm assuming it was just sort of relaxing, like you're talking about, and not trying to do anything, but looking at what was going on. Whereas here we're,
right,
you know, eyes closed. So it's just a question about the relationship to that.
Okay, so the story is there was a plowing festival. If the king would turn the first furrow when it was time for harvest. And the Buddha's father was a king, and so they were having the plowing festival. Now, if you've been to India, you know a festival is not like they get up at 8 o'clock in the morning, go out, plow, and it's done. It's a big thing, and it's going on. And the prince, Siddhartha, went and sat under a rose apple tree and fell into the first jhana. And when it was time for him to help with the plowing, because he was in the jhana, the minister who found him was sort of loath to touch him, you know, say time. And his father said, no, he can do it next year. Okay, that's the story. The suttas give the following information. After the Buddha quit doing the austerities, so 6 years after he left home, he remembered he was sitting under a rose apple tree and his father was working, and he fell into the first jhana. That's the details. That's all the details we have. All the rest of the stuff is mythology. His father wasn't a king. He was the elected chieftain of the Sakyans. Siddhartha is a name that was given to the Buddha probably 4 centuries after his death. We don't know his first name. Since his father wasn't a king, he wasn't a prince. And it wasn't a plowing ceremony. His father was working. If he was working, perhaps he was plowing. Okay. But the mythology around the Buddha, you know, grew up, and they had to make him an even better person, right? So instead of just, you know, one of you peons, it was Prince Charles, right? You know, it was one of you peons, right? So, he probably lived in the nicest house in town. He didn't have 3 palaces. Nobody in Kapilavastu had any palaces. But he, you know, it was a really good hut. And so the story is, he was sitting under the tree, and it was probably, he sat down in the cool of the shade, and he closed his eyes, and this was really nice, and he spontaneously started meditating and fell into the first jhana, which makes a whole lot more sense than he was at a festival with all this commotion and everything else. But in order to keep the Buddha, you know, elevated, the mythology that grew up, you know, elevated his status. So the answer to your question is, yeah, it was probably a nice, peaceful day. His father's working in the fields. He sat down under a tree. Yeah, stumbled into the first jhana.
On average for yourself, how long does it usually take you to get into the first jhana?
It varies anywhere from 5 seconds to infinity. If I'm on a retreat, and the retreat is going really well, and I've probably been in the jhanas multiple times that day, yeah, just sit down. I'm really concentrated. I know exactly what to do. I'm in the jhana. I remember a retreat with Ayakema. The last thing she would do in the evening was guided metta meditation. And she would say, please put your attention on your breath. And I was in the second jhana by the time she started doing the guiding, which was a minute, 2 minutes later. So, yeah, it was just really easy to get there. But, you know, sometimes I'd come home from work and, you know, I go to my sitting group and there's this really difficult bug. I've been working on it all day and, yeah, the bell rings and it was like, oh, yeah, I was supposed to follow my breath. You know, just I never even got close to any sort of concentration. Or, you know, they did that stupid thing at work and I'm just, you know, trying to... Yeah, no jhanas. So there isn't an average. It can vary a lot. If I'm on a retreat and it's the first sitting after breakfast, because I'm not a morning person, yeah, there's seldom jhanas before breakfast. There's seldom even awake before breakfast. But, you know, say the first sitting after breakfast and clean up and everything, sit down, yeah, it might take me 20 minutes. It's how quickly can I generate access concentration? Once I've got access concentration, then, yeah, the first jhana is mine as soon as I want it. Now, if I don't generate enough concentration, when I move to the second jhana, I just fall out of it because it's more subtle and I didn't have enough concentration. But, yeah, once you get good at it, yeah, if you can generate access concentration, then you can just move right in. But the generating access concentration more depends on what's going on in my life than anything else.
You described
intentionally taking a deeper breath when the breath is very subtle?
I said, don't do that.
Yeah, so, because it seems to me that that just, without intention, just naturally occurred.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, often people find that the breath gets very subtle, and then there's a big sigh. It takes you away from the jhana. So, excuse me, what I tell people is, if you start seeing the signs that that sort of breath might arise spontaneously, take a slightly deeper breath. Okay, yeah, that takes you away from the jhana as well, but it doesn't take you so far away as the deeper breath. So, if you don't breathe intentionally and you just let it go and it gets shallow, then it'll go like this as you get deeper. So if you don't intentionally breathe and it does its own, then it pulls you back up. So the idea is, all right, it's getting near to where I might take one, all right, and I do this so that I give up some of what I've got to prevent it from getting worse. So yeah, it's tricky. And this is another reason you go on a retreat. Learning the jhanas is trial and error. It's actually trial and error and error and error and error for quite a while. So, yeah, you would come to the first interview, you'd describe this, I'd give you the instructions I just gave, you know, take a slightly deeper breath. And you go, but when? And I say, you have to pay attention and figure out, you know, what are the signs that you might have a spontaneous deeper breath? And then when the signs are, it's like it's going to come soon, you take your slightly deeper breath. Yeah. So, yeah, this is tricky stuff.
I heard that in concentration meditation can get one so far, but that the only thing that takes you to liberation is insight meditation on the three marks of existence, and that's dukkha and anicca.
Yeah.
Would you be saying anything about the relationship between samatha and prasanna?
Right. Yeah. In brief, the idea is concentrate your mind and then examine reality. Examining reality with a concentrated mind is going to give you a much clearer view of anicca, dukkha, anatta than examining them just by plopping down and trying to go for it. So, yeah, and I'll talk about this more in the first talk this afternoon. All right, somebody over here.
I just wondered what was going on neurologically.
What's going on neurologically?
I'm particularly interested because I'm epileptic, so I have a sort of anxiety around it as well. So I have had quite powerful experiences, but then I panic a bit and come out because I'm scared that it might be bad for me.
Right. Yeah, so actually there's two questions there. The first is the relationship of the jhanas to someone who's prone to any sort of seizure, epileptic, or I had a student in Israel who had been shot in the head in the Six-Day War in 67, and he would sometimes have seizures, and I recommend, don't mess with the first jhana. Because when the PT comes, it's quite intense. So I have meditated for science a number of times because I'm quite curious what's going on. What I've learned is that there's considerably more activity in the left prefrontal cortex than the right prefrontal cortex for the first four jhanas. The left prefrontal cortex shows activity at positive emotions and the right at negative emotions. And as you'll see as I talk about the other jhanas, the first four are definitely positive emotions, so you would expect there would be more activity there. The parts of the brain that are associated with the sense of self get quieter. So very definitely, when it's going well, there's not a thought, oh, I'm doing this. It's just this is happening and it's being observed. But the selfing bit gets really quiet, which is part of why post-jhana, when you start doing vipassana, examining the three marks of existence, it goes so much better because you're looking at it with a less egocentric view. The other thing that we know is the nucleus accumbens, which is the reward center in the brain, just sort of right in the middle, down a bit, gets highly activated. One of the neuroscientists I work with said that when I was in the second jhana, my nucleus accumbens was in overdrive. Right. So what does the nucleus accumbens do? Well, it's the reward center. When somebody says, oh, you did such a good job on that and it feels nice, That's because the nucleus accumbens just pumped out a bunch of dopamine and opioids. Dopamine will break down into norepinephrine. Norepinephrine will cause muscle movement, muscle tension, can show up as heat. This sounds a lot like PT. So my guess is that PT is dopamine breaking down into norepinephrine. And sukha, that's joy or happiness. Opioids, well, that kind of makes you happy. So I did have a chance to check this out. My knee was bothering me one time when I sat down to meditate. And it was like, if the second jhana, which is a lot of sukha, is opioids, when I get there, my knee should not hurt as much. And so I started meditating, and yeah, my knees stopped hurting so much when I got to the second jhana. Now, I don't know that it was opioids. It may be that I'd just been sitting quietly instead of walking around on my knee that was bothering me. So it could have just been the rest that made it stop hurting. But what we know so far is, yeah, there's activity here. And we know that dopamine breaking down into norepinephrine gives symptoms that's much like PT, and that opioids symptoms much like sukha. So that's the best that we know. They could do a blood draw in my arm while I was in jhana, but that doesn't say what's going on in my brain. Okay? They'd have to do a blood draw for my brain. I'm not that curious. So we don't really know. We do have a lot of data that hasn't been analyzed. Some data has been analyzed, and I just shared with you basically what we know. There are eight jhanas. Each of the eight jhanas looks different. Okay? So there's obviously something going on. It's different from access concentration. It's different from just being at rest. But it appears the first jhana and all of the tension and almost seizure-like stuff, the best guess I have is it's dopamine breaking down into norepinephrine. Now, whether that would be any bit related to epilepsy or not, I have no idea. But that's what I know so far, and some of it's speculation.
Do you lose sensation of your body when you're in the jhanas?
Do you lose sensation of your body when you're in the jhanas? What's described in the suttas, clearly not. It says that one drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with the PT and sukha. Okay, so if you're going to do that, you have sensation of your body. But it's in the background, and it's not really noticeable. So I remember going to my usual Thursday night meditation group in Berkeley, California, and we met in the basement of a church. You know, they come in the wintertime, and it was warmer than outside, and I'd sit down to meditate. And then after 45 minutes, they'd ring the bell, and I would go, wow, it's really cold in here tonight. I hadn't noticed that because, yeah, it was just far enough away. But I hadn't lost all sensation in my body. I just wasn't paying that much attention to it. That's the suttas. By the time of the commentaries, which is 800-900 years after the Buddha, there is no bodily sensation. There's no hearing of sounds. There's not even any passage of time. So it's actually a different state. It would appear there are eight sutta jhanas and there are eight Visuddhimagga jhanas, which are different states. Some similarity, but actually quite different states. I'll talk about that a little bit more this afternoon.
Could you tell me if they're different states? Does that mean that you enter them in a different way?
Yes. Right. The teachers who teach the Visuddhimagga jhanas would say I had never even been to access concentration, let alone been in a jhana. That you would start out with the breath in both of them, but I actually worked with Venerable Pao Auk, who's a jhana master from southern Burma, who teaches Visuddhimagga jhanas. And your question, how long does it take me to get there? For someone learning Visuddhimagga jhanas, 6 months. That's the minimum you should go on retreat. And then you have a 30% chance of learning it. And then if you're going to get into those jhanas, it's probably going to take several hours to get to the first jhana. All right, so 6 months to learn it, and then it's going to take a long time staying with the breath to get into these different states.
So what's the implication here of all this information and procedure leaning into control in meditation?
The implication is, hopefully I put out enough information that you're interested in pursuing this, and that you go study with some teacher and find out if it's something that you have a skill for. And if you have a skill for it, then I can guarantee you it will enhance your insight practice.
Yeah, gotcha.
Okay?
Yeah.
Other than that, it might be just a curiosity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So, yeah, you don't even have to know any of this stuff about the neurological, or you don't even have to know how to do it if you've got the skill enough to fall into it. It's just more useful to know how to do it because you get there a lot more efficiently.
I've never intentionally managed to.
Yeah, I was stumbling in for 2 years before I learned, okay, I can do this specifically. I could learn what I was doing and then make it happen almost on demand. And then it was, yeah, once I started doing insight practice with a jhanically concentrated mind, it was life-changing. Yeah, I came back from a 5-week retreat and my friends could see I was different. My parents could see I was different.
That's saying something.
Yeah. Any other questions?
Are there insight teachers in the UK who teach the jhana? I know there is one in Guyhouse, but
This Rob Berbea.
Yeah, he's very.
He teaches the jhanas, and he teaches them similar to the way I teach them, not exactly the same, but similar. We've actually discussed jhana teaching. And then Christina Feldman teaches them as well, but she'll only teach them if you go on a 3-month self-retreat in the Hermitage Wing at Gaia House. She wants more concentration. She's not teaching at the Vasuddhi Magga level, but she's teaching more concentration than I teach. What I'm teaching is, okay, most people don't go on 3-month retreats. Okay, what can I teach people in a 10-day retreat that will enhance their insight practice? So I'm trying to be practical here because that was what I got taught and it made a big difference in my life. So I'll pass it on because it does seem to have its benefits. Other than those two, I don't know of anybody in the UK. If you speak German, there are 8 teachers in the Ayurkema tradition in Germany and you can go on their German language retreats. But, yeah. Unfortunately, yeah, Ayurkema taught herself the jhanas. Now that is just completely amazing. She didn't have the good translations we have of the suttas now. All she had was the ones done in the early part of the 20th century. And she had a good translation of the Vasuddhi Magga, which, yeah, as I say, is somewhat different, but there's some useful information in there. And she taught herself all 8 jhanas. And then she wanted to know if she was doing it right. So she was in Sri Lanka. And she asked the ladies if she was staying with, could she go visit the Venerable Nyanarama's monastery? Because she'd heard the Venerable Nyanarama was a jhana master. And the lady said, no, you can't go there. It's way back in the jungle and you got to take a jeep for 2 days and then walk in. She said, but I really need to go. And they said, but you can't go. But I really need to speak to the Venerable Nyanarama. And they said, oh, if you just want to speak to him, he's coming to town for some medical treatment. He's in the monastery around the corner. So they left where they were and walked to the nearest monastery. And she had an interview with the Venerable Nyanarama and asked, describe what she was doing and ask, am I doing it right? And he said, yes. And furthermore, you must teach them. They are in danger of becoming a lost art. So, yeah, it's very few people teaching them. We could get all of the jhana teachers I know of in the world in this room, and you could all stay in here, and nobody would be crowded. A dozen people? It's really, it's kind of scary, since especially the Buddha was defining bright concentration as jhanas. So
are you suggesting that we teach ourselves? Is that possible?
Well, can you teach yourselves? The best I can offer you is a book that I wrote that will be out October 13th. But it says in the book You can't learn the jhanas from a book. It then says, but if you want to try, here are the instructions. So the first third of the book is basically the instructions for learning the jhanas. But yeah, it's really difficult. I will be back in June of 2018 at Gaia House. I might possibly be back in October of 17 for a month-long retreat. But that's going to be a small number of people. Probably, yeah, we're hoping maybe 15 to 20 people at the most.
Is that a Gaia House?
It won't be at Gaia House, but it'll be in Devon. Gaia House will probably be undergoing renovations at the time, but they'll find someplace else if that happens. If you've got time now, I'm teaching in Germany in November and Portugal in December. So you can come to those retreats. They still have some time, some room left in them. And I teach in the States a lot.
Sorry to ask another book. Sheila Catherine has written two books on jhanas.
Yeah. Sheila's books are more oriented towards the Visuddhimagga jhanas. They're good books. Her first one, Focused and Fearless, is actually quite good. The other one, yeah, it's got too much Abhidhamma stuff in it for me. But again, it's not so much on what Ayakema and I are teaching and what I find in the suttas. It's more oriented towards the Visuddhimagga. But it's a very good, it's far more readable than Pao Ok's book, for example. And then there's Tina Rasmussen and Steve Snyder. They have a book also, they're students of Pao Ok, also on the Visuddhimagga jhanas.
But Stephen Butler has decided to sit with you. Has he done it, or is he going to do it in the States? Because I just want to ask him when he's back.
Stephen Batchelor sat the retreat I just taught at Gaia House. Yes, and it was really good to have him there. Yeah, it was very nice.
Reverend Gunaratana has written a book on jhana.
Bhante Gunaratana teaches the jhanas. He doesn't come over this side of the pond, and he doesn't teach him very much in the U.S. anymore. So, yeah, Bhante Gunaratana, a really brilliant Sri Lankan monk. He's done some amazing work. He has a monastery not too far from Washington, D.C., and he teaches jhanas occasionally, but not so often. And he has a book that actually was ghostwritten, and it's not very good. Yeah, most of his books that he wrote are really good, but happened to know this one was ghostwritten, and I was disappointed. Because I was really counting on him writing a book and I wouldn't have to.
You also just talked about the signs of the jhanas and one of them being the diffuse light. And you also said something about, you know, other kinds of lights that you might see and laser-like stuff that mm-hmm. you need to ignore. Is that correct?
All of it should be ignored. But the diffuse one is like, okay, yeah, the concentration is getting good. But then you ignore it. So all the other stuff. Now, the Visuddhimagga talks about seeing a circle of light, a nimitta. The word nimitta appears in the suttas, and it means sign. Like, if your stomach is rumbling, that's a sign you're hungry. Yeah, it has no more meaning than that. But in later commentarial literature, it comes to mean a circle of light, like a headlight of a car in your face. And you've got to get that to get into the Visuddhimagga jhanas. So if you get that, yeah, it's a sign of very good concentration. Most people to get it takes several months on retreat to get quiet enough for that to happen. But some people get it right away. The range of people who get anicca, it really surprised me. I've had people, maybe they've been meditating for a year, they've been on a couple of retreats. They come on a retreat with me and they go, what's this circle of light I'm getting all the time? And then I know other people that have been on, you know, many retreats and they never seen anything like that. So, there seems to be a, I don't know, genetic predisposition to see that circle of light. But it's not necessary at all for the jhanas as described in the suttas. And I figure whatever the Buddha was doing, it's good enough for me.
This one's more personal. Sometimes when I, either through insight or through concentration, through metta, breath, or insight practices, you get like, it's like an expanding out of, like a loosening out of things, but then also comes a kind of like a lot of energy, and I can feel my heart pumping quite a lot.
Yeah, that would be piti.
Because sometimes sometimes it's shot through with some like almost fear, or almost like or it brings thoughts with like, oh God, I need someone to hold my, or like I need a teacher, I don't want him.
Yeah, if you get very strong PT coming on without you intending it to happen, it can be quite scary because your heart rate can go up quite a lot. I figure mine probably goes up when it's really strong, 90 beats a minute. It comes on really strong. It's like you stuck your finger in the electrical socket. I mean, it's just really there. And you don't know what's going on, and it's frightening. It's fear of the unknown. The actual experience itself isn't fearful once you understand what's going on. But yeah, if you don't have a teacher and you get PT coming on, and it comes on really strongly like that. For me, when it first came on, it wasn't so intense. It had a lot of sukha mixed with it, and so it had a lot of happiness and joy as well as the energy. And so, yeah, it was like very cool. But people who get the really intense stuff, yeah, it can be quite scary.
Because I find after it kind of, maybe it's because the thoughts kind of dampen it down and they push out the concentration, but afterwards I do find that I'm kind of a little bit like, I'm still quiet, but nowhere near as quiet as I was before that came on.
Right. And I would guess that it's the fear that's the major thing that's driving the concentration away. I mean, concentration means you're just paying attention to one thing. Fear comes up, hey, something's wrong, pay attention. And so, yeah, you immediately come out of that relaxed into a very nice, deep space to, yeah, what do I do with this? And so it's just to recognize that, okay, this is what happens. I'll talk about the other jhanas and I'll talk some more about the first one this afternoon. So maybe if it comes again, you'll have a better idea. But the key thing, if it gets to be too intense, remember I said, don't take a breath, it takes you away from the jhana. If it gets too intense, take a breath, it takes you away from the jhana. And so getting a sense of, okay, I got control over this. Or it comes, it's really strong, my heart rate's up, I take a deep breath. Oh yeah, I chilled out, and I didn't lose my concentration. And so then the next time, yeah, it's, you know what to do, and there's no fear.
What if that buzzing energy stays with you for longer? I had no opportunity to ask anyone. I had no access to a teacher, even though I was on a retreat, but it was so busy that we got those, you know, short interviews. And it stayed with me. It was a 10-day retreat. I was doing samadhi. I was very happy, you know. And then, and it stayed with me almost to the end of the retreat.
Yeah.
I kind of translated it as anger, because I was buzzing. I was almost, you know, knocking off the walls.
Yeah.
When I was, you know, like practice, and it was still every time I started to practice.
Yeah.
And it happened twice. The second time, I kind of brought it on because I was curious.
Uh-huh.
So the next time I did a retreat, I brought it on. It was 5-day retreat. And again, I had no idea what it was.
Yeah.
Most, I started to do metta practice.
Yeah.
And
which is,
it dissipated.
Yeah, you know? Good. Most likely it was PT. Okay? So sometimes people get the PT stuck on. If it comes on strong, as soon as it starts to get, okay, this is really strong, take a deep breath and see if you can quiet it immediately. Don't let it run for a long time.
I was curious. That is why.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and it's interesting.
I had no one to talk about it.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate. I mean, no. but yeah, if you get really strong PT, and particularly if it persists, then when the next time when it comes, take a deep breath immediately and let it go. I've been on retreat where I've had a lot of background PT. It wasn't strong at other times, but I could tell it was just back there. I'll talk about that some more this afternoon. But yeah, if it's too much, you want to bail out as quickly as you can by taking a deep breath.
I quite like it at the same time.
Yeah, yeah, if you like it. But you probably like the deeper states better.
Yeah.
So.
I'm wondering about getting into, well, I'll tell my story. When I first went on retreat, but this was a very long time ago, I had no experience when I was actually meditating. But when I left, I then suddenly went into an alternate state of consciousness, which was beautiful. I mean, it was just, it was a very calm state in which everything looked beautiful, absolutely beautiful, and a sense of real connection with every human being, every place.
Right.
And it went on for about an hour and a half.
Nice.
So is that a jhana? Or, I mean, why would I feel it afterwards? And
Yeah, part of why it didn't happen during the retreat is that you were working really hard on something. You had instructions and you were doing that. After the retreat, you still had good concentration because, you know, retreat does have effects for a little while. And you were relaxed. And you just relaxed and opened up to what was there, and then this came over you. It doesn't sound so much like a jhana as more of an insight state of really seeing clearly what's there and seeing the connection and all this other stuff. But it probably was enhanced by the concentration you generated during that retreat and then the relaxed state afterwards.
So what's the difference between, sorry, an insight state and a jhana state?
Well, the jhana states are 8 specific altered states of consciousness, and I will explain them in detail this afternoon. An insight state is a state in which you're seeing, well, anicca, dukkha, anatta, the changeable nature of everything, the unsatisfactory nature of everything, and or the fact that everything depends on other things. It sounds to me like you were getting more of the, you know, the interconnected, the everything is dependent on other things state of it. So, yeah. You're gaining insight into the nature of reality, whereas the jhanas are specific concentration states, and I'll give you all of them in as much detail as I can.
You use the word expectation. Don't expect.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, to be honest, listening to all that, I'm seeing a beautiful carrot growing.
Yes, yes. With strawberry on top.
The first teacher I had always used to warn us, you know, you definitely, it's promised that you'll go wrong if you start with doing something with a desired result.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
So what can you say about that?
Yeah, I had this beautiful analogy. Suppose you want to drive from London to Gaia House. Right? And somebody gives you the instructions. And it says, okay, drive down the street you live on. When you get to the end, you want to turn right. And you get to the big intersection, you turn right again. And then you go to get to the M whatever. And, okay, if you start looking for Gaia House as you're driving down the street you live on, you're liable to run into a parked car. Right? You're not going to find it. But you need to pay attention to where you are, what you're supposed to do where you are, and what the landmark is when you start doing something else. So I put out the carrot. And then when you sit down, you forget about the carrot and you remember only the directions of how to get to the carrot. Right? So first direction, comfortable upright posture. Right? And so after you've got that settled, put your attention on your meditation object, the breath. Okay, you got that. No, wait, you got lost. Bring it back. Oh, you got a label, got to relax. All right? So you're not thinking about the jhana. You're just doing that sort of stuff. Okay, access concentration. Now you're on the M4? Is that what go that way? All right, it's moving along pretty nicely. Not even any traffic. Okay? And now you got to shift to, the M35 or something, and that's the pleasant sensation. All right? But you don't want to, you know, you don't want to shift too soon because then you just run off into a ditch, right? So when it's the right time, you shift to the new thing, which is the pleasant sensation. And just keep going is what it says. Don't look for Gaia House. Turns out that, you know, it dead ends right at Gaia House. Dead ends right at the carrot. So it's a matter of not focusing on the result. You might sit down and go, okay, I'm going to work on the jhana on this. What are the instructions? You look, review the instructions. Okay, what do I do first? But you forget about the end results. That's the best that I can give you. And yeah, it's very tricky. Yeah.
I've been practiced with choiceless awareness, just to whatever.
Right.
You know, I think. Do I have to turn to the breath to?
Yeah. Choiceless awareness isn't one-pointed enough to get you to access concentration. You'll get quiet. That's true. But generally speaking, I would say choiceless awareness is not a good concentration practice. Having said that, I have had a few students who were able to use choiceless awareness to get to access concentration, and then they had to shift to a pleasant sensation. So it is possible, but I've also had a much larger number of students have to abandon their choiceless awareness practice and really work with deep concentration with the breath or metta or something.
Can I say one more thing? Mm-hmm. So I did a 3-month retreat at IMS, and I was focusing on the breath, and the instructor at some point felt that I was tightening up too much on the breath, my attention was. So she suggested attending to sound and body sensation, et cetera.
Right.
Eventually that went to choiceless awareness.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if...
What I would tell you if you were on my retreat is, all right, you're getting too tight, you're trying too hard. Remember, it's relaxed diligence. Work on the relaxed, okay? Hang out with the breath, but not clench to it. Just kick back and relax. So I'm giving you different directions. Your teacher was giving you something that would take you in the direction of insight. I'm giving you something to take you in the direction of concentration that's actually workable. So, different teachers, different directions. Yeah, if you sit with 20 different teachers, I would be very surprised if you only got 19 different sets of directions.
When you were saying about sticking your finger in the plug socket...
when I was...
saying about sticking your finger in
the... Yeah, in the electrical socket.
I've sort of had feelings like that, not from any sort of sustained access concentration, but just from momentarily, looking like what's going on. And then, I don't know if that's anything to do with all of this. And I sort of, at first I thought, oh, that's good,
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, oh, but then I don't want to attach to that or anything. Like, oh, just come back to whatever. And I just sort of forgot about it. And then that just reminded me what he said.
Yeah. For the momentary PT, it's a little tricky because, you might get a little insight that startles you. And the startle response could mimic that.
It felt completely physical, not even emotional at all. Not like when you get a strong emotional thing, meditation, just a purely complete...
The fact that it was purely physical, then it would probably be momentary PT. There also is the incomplete motion, right? So you start to do something and you don't, but it's an incompleteness that's in the body. And sometimes what happens that's a physical thing is sort of the body wants to complete that motion. And that maybe comes up and can mimic PT. So I can't really say in this case. You say you were well concentrated. Then it could very well be momentary PT, or it could be some other thing. You might notice that, sometimes when you're falling asleep, your body suddenly jerks. Okay, that can happen in meditation as well. You're quite concentrated, but your energy is really low, and you get a jerk like that. That doesn't sound like what happened there. So for the momentary PT, it's really hard to say. I'd say, okay, take it as a good sign, do what you were doing before and see if it comes to a place where it sustains, but I can't really say.
Then you don't concentrate on that itself, that isn't the focus.
Yeah. Basically, you've got to focus on something that will take you to access concentration, right? And ignore all the other things that are happening along the way. And then you switch to a pleasant sensation and you focus on that and you ignore everything else along the way, although it will start increasing, as you notice, and then the PT and Sukha will show up. The PT might come as a burst. People do get that. They've got good access. They switch to the pleasant sensation. PT comes and goes away. Okay, if that happens, you just keep doing what you were doing because at least you're going in the right direction. But yeah, mostly if you shift to some side effect that's showing up, then the whole thing is going to fade away. You've got to keep doing the thing that's generating whatever this side effect is. I like to put it, you got to dance with the one that brung you. So. Well, it's noon. We're going to eat at 12:30. So I suggest we sit for 20 minutes and you work with, you know, trying to play with the instructions and see what it's like. And then I'll see if there's more questions. I'll ring a bell at 10 past for those who are going to go help with the setup, unless you want to go now. Okay, I'm getting the word. If you're going to help with the setup for lunch,